You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Jonathan Dee's latest novel, The Thousand Pardons, is a fast-moving and often funny story of a family in crisis. When it opens, Ben and Helen Armstead are on their way to their weekly marriage counseling session, and by the end of the first chapter, they have filed for divorce. Helen has returned to work after 14 years as a stay-at-home mom, and Ben has checked into a rehab facility after his drinking and his sexual harassment of a summer associate get him fired from his job at a white-collar or white-shoe law firm. The book, Jonathan Dee Six, is published by Random House, and I'm very pleased that it has brought him back to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Nice to be back.
This book has been described by readers as a real page-turner and hard to put down. There's a lot going on here. How much of the entire story had you fleshed out in your mind before you started writing the novel?
Unusually for me, I had almost the whole thing before I started. It's very self-contained. It has a particularly tight plot, and it's short. So I could see the whole thing from the beginning this time.
Well, you teach in the graduate writing program at Columbia University and the New School. Could you ask your students to read this novel as an example of how to show rather than tell?
I wouldn't dare, in fact. It's always nerve-wracking to have one student read one's published work and offer their critiques of it, because you can tell they've been waiting for their opportunity. But I tried my best, as I say, to make it as self-contained, as hermetic as possible.
As I mentioned, this is your sixth novel. You were here how many years ago? 3 years ago?
Three.
To discuss The Privileges, which was a finalist for the 2010 Pulitzer Prize and won the 2011 Prix Fitzgerald. Is this novel more plot-driven than your earlier books?
I think so. I mean, I think it all goes to the nature of the content of the book, which has to do with the mechanics of public contrition, public forgiveness, which to me, what's interesting about those rituals, which take place really practically once a week at this point, is that they're religious in nature. They're a kind of ghost of what used to be American public life, in which the notion of religion was in the forefront.
So is that what got you started, watching some politician apologize for an indiscretion?
Well, I think whether it's a politician or whether it's an institution or a corporation, like I say, it's a very disparate group of people and entities that are fed to this ritual, and yet the ritual is always the same. And that's what got me interested in it.
What's amazing is that often people can recover. Mark Sanford is now the favorite to win an election is it North Carolina or South Carolina?
South Carolina, I think.
Despite some pretty embarrassing stuff.
Absolutely. If you do it right, if you observe the ritual correctly, you can come back from it. And yet people still resist it, as we see in other cases.
When the story of this novel opens, Helen and Ben are living in the suburbs north of the city with their 14-year-old adopted daughter, Sarah, and we learn that Ben's been depressed for some time. Does Helen have any idea what's troubling him?
She doesn't. I think that she's in denial about that until she can no longer deny it. Ben, obeying a really dark impulse that I don't think he understands, he begins the novel, as you say, by really burning down what's been a pretty successful life and incurring the contempt of everyone who knows him.
Well, does he have any idea what's wrong?
No.
He appears to be in the throes of midlife crisis, but he refuses to give what's happening to him that label. What does he call it instead?
I remember that he...
Existential.
Yeah, that's right. He refuses the term midlife crisis very directly.
And that distinction is really important to him.
It is, because there's something wrong, not with him, he feels, not because of the age he is, but because of the life he's living, which he needs to rid himself of in order to reexamine it.
Now, some novelists would have made the end of Ben and Helen's marriage the main subject of a novel, but for you, it's just the starting point. Did you know from the start that you were more interested in what would happen after Ben and Helen's breakup than the breakup itself?
Yes. It's hard, frankly, to unless you really want to spend an entire novel dissecting a marriage, as a writer like Christina Stead might do, it's hard to make it seem all that dramatic. So I was more interested in the aftermath.
Well, I've always loved The Man Who Loved Children, but not too many people read it these days.
No, they should.
the marriage falls apart soon after a cyclist finds Ben with his face badly beaten, passed out drunk in his car by the side of a road. How had he gotten into that state?
Well, he, as you say, sexually harasses a young summer associate at his law firm. And in the end, as badly as he behaves, what really brings him down is that he's accused of something he didn't do, which is sexually assaulting her.
The cyclist snaps a photo of Ben with his cell phone, and the story makes the front page of the newspapers. Mm-hmm. Why is this a front page story? He's a lawyer. He's not a famous politician.
It's a great tabloid story. I think you never have to wait too long if you read the New York tabloids in particular to come upon a story of some successful Brahmin who has been brought down by his own dark sexual impulses.
Yeah, well, we can think of some of the recent tabloid headlines we were suggesting earlier. Elliot Spitzer, Anthony Weiner, Arnold Schwarzenegger, although the list goes on and on and on. Sometimes their wives stand by these men and they make their public apologies. Did you consider having Helen play that role of the loyal wife?
No.
Or the good wife, as the television show would have it?
No. Well, she's very angry. And also just from a practical standpoint, she doesn't really have that option. Ben goes into rehab, really not because he has an addiction problem, but to hide from the cops. And they are more or less ordered by their lawyer to get divorced as quickly as possible.
And on the advice of his attorney, a funny character in his own right, Joe Bonifacio, Ben doesn't offer a public apology. Is he given bad advice?
He is. Helen and Joe become, even though Joe is technically Helen's lawyer also, they're philosophical adversaries in a way. Joe is all about strategically denying guilt. He has a very traditional legal mindset. The offense Helen takes at that is part of what gets her started on her new path.
She has a special gift for knowing how to apologize, and she discovers it when she's forced back to work to support herself and her daughter after Ben goes into rehab. He's also been disbarred, hasn't he?
Disbarment proceedings take place against him. It's an open question whether they'll succeed.
So although she hasn't worked in years, she's able to line up four interviews for her first day out, and one of them is with a small PR agency, and that results in a job offer. PR is where we often have people dealing with crises of this sort.
Yes. It's a job that she stumbles into, and it's important, I think, that she's not in any way representative of that business. She has no training in it, no experience at all. She really has one idea, one strategy, and that is to confess.
Is it typical? I mean, in this climate, that somebody would get four interviews on their first day out and get a job?
I've heard that before, and they're not very good interviews, and they're not very successful. In fact, even the job that she gets, she's at first turned down for. I think if you go on Craigslist, you can find interviews for crappy jobs, I think, even today.
And her job is really crisis management.
It becomes that because she shows a flair for it. Yeah.
She's able to convince powerful men to admit their mistakes and apologize in a way that allows them to be forgiven and start over.
Yes. She was brought up in a religious household, in a Catholic school, and this is her one idea. And I think, as often happens in the business world, it's so old-fashioned that it comes off as revolutionary.
Well, when I've had some of the politicians who have had these disgraces come on my show years later talking about something that they are fully expert in, there's always a number of complaints from listeners. How could you put that sleazeball on your show?
Sure.
She tells these people how to apologize, and she has a right way and a wrong way to apologize.
Yes, the right way is completely and abjectly to make an offering of yourself to the public, in essence, and not to try to hedge in any way, not to say I'm guilty, but just to go the whole nine yards from the start.
And it doesn't matter whether you really feel that you did something wrong or not.
No, it doesn't. She says to one client that even if you aren't guilty of this, surely you're guilty of something else.
Jonathan Dee's latest novel is A Thousand Pardons. It's published by Random House. Did you think of it as a book that also was going to be funny from the start?
I did. I did hope it was going to be funny. I was very cheered to hear you say so, actually.
Well, is funny something that just comes naturally? Or do you have to later say, gee, I haven't been funny for a couple of pages, I better do something here?
No, I think it has to come in your initial conception of the work. It would be hard to go back and put in jokes later.
Mm-hmm. So. Her first client is the owner of a chain of Chinese restaurants who's been vilified in the press because of his alleged mistreatment of his delivery staff. We've heard stories like that. She persuades him to apologize even though he believes that he's in the right?
That's right. The force of her conviction winds up convincing him and winds up succeeding for him. That's the beginning of her success.
And he becomes something of a local hero, in fact.
He does.
Is it a coincidence that Helen is able to work so effectively with the Chinese restaurant owner but seems unable to communicate with her own daughter, Sarah, who has been adopted from China?
It is a coincidence, yes.
It wasn't meant to be ironic.
No, no.
I ask because during the novel, Sarah is questioned by her boyfriend about her background, and he implies that racism has played some role in her family.
She does fall under the sway briefly of a young man who thinks that her parents, that all parents basically are consumed by guilt, and adoptive parents in particular, that the adoption itself is a sort of crime which they're always trying to make up for.
No, I think I've heard you have a teenage daughter.
That's correct.
Sarah's not a very likable character. She's an unhappy teenager without many redeeming qualities.
Just a
coincidence?
Absolutely. I hear that often, and actually I think that's probably the aspect of readers' reaction to the book that I'm most surprised by, because I think Sarah, frankly, is adorable.
After Helen has a couple of other professional successes, she's hired by a major Manhattan PR agency to join its crisis management team. The sections of your novel where you write about that firm, which you've called Malloy, are really funny. Did you need to do much research into the PR industry to put that together?
I needed to do some, but really all my research takes place on the page. I think the best possible research for almost anything is to read any kind of first-person account, any kind of memoir from someone who is successful in that field, and crisis management in particular is full of people like that. And in fact, when they write their memoirs, the fact that they usually can't disclose who their clients were just means that they talk about themselves more. Mm-hmm. So a stack of books like that was an enormous help. Yeah.
Your book contains a second storyline I haven't mentioned yet about an alcoholic movie star named Hamilton Barth. Helen knew him as a child, and he gets himself into a crisis. She helps him work it out.
Yes, he does. He gets himself into a crisis in which he's convinced that he has committed a rather terrible crime, but it's an open question whether or not he's right.
And what happens to her husband, Ben? He's been accused of a crime he didn't really commit. I mean, he was on the way to committing. To doing
yes,
something
he's certainly,
unacceptable, but
he's certainly
he didn't
guilty.
Do it.
He didn't do it. He's certainly guilty of other things, and I think his disgrace at the end of chapter one is so complete that you might think he's out of Helen's life, out of his daughter's life, and really out of the book, but he hangs around, and sure enough, at some point, Helen calls upon him to do her an important service.
Because this book is called 1,000 Pardons, and anyone can be pardoned.
Yes.
Jonathan Dee's novel, 1,000 Pardons, is published by Random House. It's already gotten wonderful pre-reviews because your publisher sent it out to a lot of readers, I guess, to create some buzz, and the buzz has been all positive.
Well, thank you.
I said it's published by Random House. What else can I say other than thank you so much for being on our show?
It's my pleasure. Thank you.